How about that? Am I on up there? Can you hear me too? Yes? No, you can't. Okay. All right, now can you hear me up there? I'll bet. Can you hear me too? She's not listening, otherwise she could hear me. Can you hear me too? Two? Can you hear me? Can you hear me too? No, you can't hear me? Okay, can people in the back row hear me? Yes? Can you hear me? In the back row. Thank you. Got it. All right. We're on. Important information. The writing exercises from last week are here on the table if you haven't picked yours up. If you don't have time or can't get down here, at the end of class or after the review session, you can pick them up in C150 Living Learning. Next week is the exam here, unless your last name begins with the letters G through N, any of those, including, you will go to Fleming Museum 101. Simple enough? Everybody else will come here. Bring a number 2 pencil, please, for the obnoxious part of the exam. Review sessions here after class today. Friday, these were the times that got most hands in the air. That's what they got. Friday from 2 to 3:30 in Rowell, 103. And Sunday from 7 to 8:30. I have requested that room, but I've not gotten it confirmed yet. So I will confirm that. You will find these also on the web. After I do get confirmation, I'll put them on the website. I will also take advantage of the registrar's email system and send every one of you who's registered your own personal email reminding you of these things within the next day or two. Okay. So, maximum technology. Questions? Welcome to our visitors today from away. Yes? Are the review sessions the same? Yeah, I understand the question. The format is the same, and to the extent that the questions are the same, then what I cover is the same. But my experience is that while there's overlap among them, different things get covered in each review session, because I depend on the questions that you bring and what you want help understanding, rather than... It would be fun. Have any of you ever seen the Reduced Shakespeare Company perform? Isn't that fun? They do all of Shakespeare's plays in one evening. They do all but one of them before the intermission. They just do them all. And then after the intermission, they spend the rest of the time on Hamlet. Hamlet. And you know, it's really fun to see the whole play reduced to 45 minutes or so. I can't do that with the course, and that's not what the review sessions are. So I depend on your questions, and I'll try to answer those and promote some discussion. Yes? I'm sorry, any food? Oh. No, it'll be question based. Yes.
Where is the Fleming Museum?
Where is the Fleming Museum? Out either direction, and there's one building or two between us and it. It's to the east, between here and the hospital. 101 is in the basement. I don't know if it comes up if you Google it, but it's a nice, comfortable room. They've renovated it. Nice and cozy. Smaller than this one. Other questions? Yes? No. No, I assume you're holding up the puberty chart. Yeah, no, you do not have to fill it out, reproduce it, fill in the blanks on it. Just know the general trends as I went over them on Monday. I'm not into filling your head with all the details and trivia. Yes. What?
What's on the test book? Multiple choice on this board?
Yes. 50 multiple choice and 6 essays. Good. Different up here. I like it, except I can't move my overheads now. Questions about puberty? Did you have bad dreams after my final comment on Monday? No? The final comment on Monday was, anybody remember? You. If you're 20 or 21,
does it all go downhill?
Yeah, you're at the peak of development physiologically. And if you're at the peak, where can you go? Down. Down. That's what adulthood is about. You've been so eager to become adults. Right? Remember that? You got through puberty and you were saying, oh, I'm almost an adult now. Now I'm off to college and I'm an adult now. What you didn't know is that there is no gold at the end of the rainbow when you get to adulthood. In fact, although you can vote, serve in the armed forces, pay more taxes, you can do all of those things, what really happens is gradual decline in the functioning of all of your organ systems, every single one of them, including your sensory systems, increased vulnerability to disease, increased recovery time following stress or disease or exertion or injury. That's why I ran up the stairs, so you could figure out how long it takes me to get back to baseline on my respiration rate. And a shift from acute to chronic illnesses. Acute illnesses are the ones that grab you by the throat. Literally, for some of you, strep throat. Viruses, colds, bang, you're sick. And then you hope to recover. Chronic illnesses are the ones that you get and fight the rest of your life. And what happens as we get older is that we suffer during your 20s and 30s. Most of you will have primarily acute illnesses, and you will recover from them. And as you get up into your 40s and 50s, as many of you are seeing with your parents now, they are beginning to have chronic problems. They have high blood pressure. They're developing diabetes. They're developing arthritic joints, rheumatism, all of those other wonderful things. And there's a significant difference between acute and chronic illnesses. The difference is that with an acute illness you can expect to recover. It may take some work, a broken leg, that sort of thing, you know, take some time to heal. But with rehabilitation you can expect to come back to where you were before it happened. There is definitely a dead spot for the microphone, and it is right here in front of seat 111, and if I move over here, it comes back on. Okay. Now I'm convinced. I don't know. I'll give you a personal example of the acute and chronic difficulty. I have never had a chronic illness. There's nothing wrong. Baldness is not a chronic illness. It's an evolutionary advance to have less hair. You know, and people with less hair. No, I'm not going to go into the family jokes. If you grow up in my family where most of us look like the males look like this, you develop some routines about it. Grass doesn't grow on busy streets, and I'm not bald. I have a wide heart. And my favorite is, men who are bald in the front are great thinkers. Men who are bald in the back are great lovers. Men who are bald both just think they're great lovers. But as I was approaching 60, getting into my late 50s, the ophthalmologist has been watching the pressure in my eyeballs since I was a young man, because it's high. And because my father and grandfather both suffered from glaucoma, some forms of which are hereditary. So they did the glaucoma tests every year and then every 6 months. And finally, an ophthalmologist began to see some damage. The high pressure, if you're not aware of it, the high pressure within the eye begins to damage the optic nerve. So you get some cupping, and then eventually you develop blind spots. And for many people, you begin to lose your peripheral vision. You become sensitive to glare and things of that sort. So one fine day, the ophthalmologist whom I'd been visiting every 6 months for years and years and years, same ophthalmologist, 30 years. And he always went through the same routine. Well, we're checking for this, we're checking for that, everything looks fine. You know, see you in 6 months. I never saw him get excited about anything. Bedside manner of a, I don't know, what. Anyway. He looked again, he said, I'm beginning to see a little change in the edge of the optic nerve. And then he got really excited. Because he had something, I had something he could treat. So he got excited and prescribed, for the very, very first time, I had to take a medication. It's just an eye drop that goes in the eye and reduces the pressure. But my response to that is very typical with what happens when people are told by a physician that they have some chronic problem. And mine, this one is extremely simple. It's very easy to control. There's no damage if you put the drops in when you're supposed to. And mine is the simple form. It's really not a problem. But what it did for me was remind me, A, that I'm mortal. It's a nasty feeling. I'm not going to live forever and be just like I used to be. And I have to continually renew the prescription for the medication. And that means that I began to have wonderful nightmares. So I asked you if you had nightmares yet. About what would happen if we had a nuclear war and I had to go underground. Where would I find my medication? And if I didn't find it, then how long would it take me to go blind? Because that's what happens with glaucoma. And it was the first time in my life I had been dependent on something. Hopefully we won't have a nuclear war, but I will be headed to the drugstore to get a lifetime supply, if we do. But you can imagine, and some of you have the experience with parents or grandparents or aunts or uncles, and perhaps yourself, having a chronic illness that is much more severe than that. And I'm not terribly worried about that one, but many of us during our 30s and 40s and later develop difficulties that require medications which are more powerful and which sometimes have side effects that you don't like. High blood pressure, for example, there are several different types of medication. And what the doctor tells you, what the physician will tell you when you get diagnosed with the high blood pressure is, we're going to give you this medication. You need to take it the rest of your life. If you don't, you'll probably have a stroke within 10 years or so, and that's it. You know, and if you're 40 or 45 when that happens, it's not a nice kind of message to get. And then they give you the medication, and whichever type it is will have side effects, and you read the list, and you figure you might as well just have the stroke. I was chatting with a friend of mine who's a few years younger than I am. We work out in the same gym. And I asked him how things were going, and he said, "Terrible. Terrible. I'm on my third blood pressure medication. And I can't exercise." He was just... He'd been on the Stairmaster for about 10 minutes and he was just wiped. He said, "It's the medication. It makes me exhausted. I can't do it." And he was really feeling very out of sorts because of that, because it was a change in lifestyle. I said, "So why did you change?" He said, "I'm not ready to give up sex yet." And the second medication, the first one caused all kinds of problems. The second one caused impotence. And his wife wasn't happy about that, and neither was he. So he switched to the third one, which makes him fatigued. And this is what people begin to deal with as they try to extend quality of life and keep from having the stroke or whatever else they're going to get. So life changes as you switch from those acute illnesses to the chronic ones. And the chronic ones become more common, and people develop more of them as they go through adulthood. Okay, tonight you'll have nightmares. Okay, let's look at the gradual decline. The reality is that if you look at almost anything in your body, here's this chart that's fairly typical. Okay. And across the bottom, what you see is 20, 40, 60, 80. This is based on longitudinal studies. Cross-sectional will give you pretty much the same reaction. And the percent of your maximum function. So what you see is at 20 or the early 20s, if you measure the function, and these are nerve conduction, speed, kidney function, that's the ability of the kidney to clear substances from your body that it needs to, cardiovascular function, your heart output and recovery rate, muscle strength, useful lung volume, and maximum breathing capacity. Okay. The sort of a randomly chosen group. They all start where you are, or where you will be shortly, and then they go down at different rates. Okay. Nerve conduction speed is fairly stable because it's based on a chemical reaction. Maximum breathing capacity goes down fairly rapidly because you stop exercising. If you stop exercising, it goes down. And if you look at that, you're down at 20% for maximum breathing capacity. 35% of your useful lung volume compared to where you were. You're not going to be running marathons if that happens to you. More nightmares. Here's another. I just collect these from various places. This one started at 30, so these people were actually probably already going down. It's a basal metabolic rate, and this one has a misprint. Basal is B-A-S-A-L. It's not the herb. Not how fast you can digest basil. It goes down, but not a lot. The work rate, cardiac output, maximum respiratory capacity again. And this shows up in every study that you do. I mentioned the sensory systems, is visual acuity. This is 10, this is 20, 30. Visual acuity stays pretty stable until you get up over 50, and then the eyeball starts changing shape, the lens starts getting thicker, and acuity goes down. Odor identification, again, peak where you are, fairly steady, fairly stable until 50 or 60, and then decline. So older people often can't detect the differences in flavor or food. It's one of the reasons they tend to, may, lose interest in eating, because stuff just doesn't smell good to them anymore. Similar things happen to taste. Speech intelligibility goes down, so hearing declines as well, the ability to pick speech out of surrounding noise. Oh, life's a drag. And life is full of changes. So one of the things that will continue to happen to you, it's happening already, but you will continue to have changes. Many of them will be wonderful changes, things that you'll like to do, getting married, having children, buying new houses, changing jobs, getting rich, winning the megabucks, all of those things that you hope will happen, inheriting a great deal of money from a parent that you don't like, wonderful things. But they are all changes, and the basic principle in life is that all of those changes, good or bad, are stressful. This is work by Holmes and Rahib, done in St. Louis many years ago. And what they did, they wanted to know how stressful life was for people, and if it was stressful, what effect that had. And the text gives you a brief synopsis of this, but what happened for them was that they looked at people who came into the hospital, adults who came into the hospital with major problems. They liked the heart attack, stroke, you know, out of control diabetes, those sorts of things. And they asked people to fill out a checklist, and then to add all of the changes that had happened in their lives in the previous year or two or three, I've forgotten the details. And then they had a control group of people who weren't hospitalized and asked them about the changes that were happening in their lives. And what they found was a significant difference. And they could quantify that difference by statistically calculating the association between any particular life change and the probability of getting sick, a major illness, being hospitalized. And what they found was that some changes are worse than others. The very worst one is the death of a spouse. That was most likely to be associated with hospitalization within a year. So they assigned that 100 points and then arranged all the rest in order of how closely related they were, how much they contributed to the likelihood that you would be hospitalized. Divorce is next, marital separation. It's interesting. Tuck that one away. Tuck that one away for when we get to the third unit and start talking about social relationships. The top 1, 2, 3 and death of a close family member and getting married and a reconciliation, getting back together with a spouse and change in the health of family member, all of those are about relationships. Others are not. Jail term, well, it might be about relationships, since going to jail is likely to get you divorced, for one, if you're married. Personal injury might affect your relationships. Anyway, my point is that if you want to avoid stress and stay out of the hospital, don't have any personal relationships. Because they are hard on you. They're difficult. Pregnancy, getting a new family member. I reminded my son-in-law of that recently, that he was very stressful for me. He was in the process of doing some very nice work in my house. But, death of a close friend, changing jobs, taking out a mortgage, having your mortgage foreclosed. Julie, remind me that that word is misspelled. I'd never caught that before. I need a new copy of this. Getting a promotion. That's only the first page. Then there's the second page. Keeps right on going. Having your kid leave home. Did you realize that by coming to college? You stressed your parents, and they've told you that. An outstanding, winning the genius prize. $100,000 now. The MacArthur Prize is $100,000 a year for 5 years, no strings attached. I guess 28 points. There's one that isn't on here that probably should be. You can go through that list sometime on your... One that isn't is winning the megabucks. Literally, winning the megabucks is very stressful. And people get sick. So, the general principle is that major changes in life are stressful, and stress contributes to biological decline. And the more stressed you are, and the more difficulty you have managing your stress, the more likely you are to become sick and to develop chronic illnesses. And it increases, a high degree of stress increases the probability of premature death. And premature death means before the maximum human lifespan, which is somewhere around 110. So if you die before then, it may be because you've had a lot of stress in your life. Okay, more nightmare stuff. Looking at people who have health problems in addition to stress. All those things you fortunately were educated about and have chosen to leave out of your life forever and never engage in now. That's a good start. If you look at the major factors underlying chronic illness in adulthood, it's alcohol abuse, smoking, poor diet, particularly fat and salt, and lack of exercise. It's not your genes, it's not accidents, it's not luck. It's what you choose to do or not do. Why do people die? Well, the causes, you don't have to remember these, and they're largely in the text in some form or other. If you look at why people die, For 1999, this is data from the Centers for Disease Control, the biggest killer is heart disease. Smoking, diet, and exercise contribute to heart disease. Cancer, smoking contributes to cancer. Stroke, smoking, diet, lack of exercise contribute to the probability of having a stroke. Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, if you're not a miner or work in a factory that has polluted air, smoking is the biggest cause. Accidents are way down there, 96,000 as opposed to 8 times that for heart disease. Pneumonia and influenza, get your flu shots anyway, but at your age it's not likely to kill you. Diabetes, suicide, nephritis, kidney disease, liver disease, and that's largely contributed to by alcohol abuse. And where do we put our money? There are a couple of things that aren't on this list. And one of the things that isn't on this list is drug abuse. If you look at the number of heroin deaths in the United States in any year, it's around or less than 10,000. Way down the list. Which makes funding the war on drugs not make much sense from a health, public health perspective. Not that I'm in favor of using heroin, but would be interesting, and somebody probably has these data, nursing students, ask one of your instructors about this one. How much does the federal government spend on each life loss prevented by drug abuse? Preventing the loss of a life that's lost from drug abuse as opposed to cardiovascular disease. How much do we spend, and what's the payoff in lives saved for those gains? I don't know, for those expenditures. One way to think about lives lost in adulthood is to look at, and this one has some problems, but the Centers for Disease Control look at people who die before 65. They're assuming that you will work and be productive until you're 65. For you, that's going to change because you're not going to be able to get your Social Security until you're 67. But for me, it's 65. So they'll have to change the way they do this. But if you look at the number of years that are lost, 40% of them are by injury. And that's because injuries, accidents, kill the young. So if you die at 18, then you lose 47 years. If you die at 50, you lose 15 years in this calculation. But the big ones are cancer and heart disease. It's another way of looking at why we die. Okay. That's right. I'm just trying to find my notes, which are buried in the overheads here. Okay. One piece of advice. It may sound like I'm on a soapbox. Anyway, but one piece of advice. Genes are involved. I didn't mean to imply that there's nothing genetic about how you're going to grow old. So one of the pieces of advice that we can pass along is for you to look at your parents and how they are aging. What illnesses do they have? How much cardiovascular capacity? How are they taking care of themselves? And for some of you, the advice would be, do what they're doing. That's good. Another personal example. My father died at 61 of a heart attack after rheumatic fever when he was young, so his heart had been damaged. He made it to 61. My mother is 92, going on 93. I think I have her genes. Please. I want her genes. We kind of think alike. We sort of look alike. I'm more like her than I am my father in many ways. And that's very pleasing because it suggests that I have her genes. And if I have a good complement of genes from her biologically and did not have the rheumatic fever that damaged my father's heart, I didn't have that, so I've gotten to 63 healthy, I can look forward to living to 93 or 95. That's my goal. It'd be nice to be 100, but I'm not sure. 95. Mom gave up doing Nautilus because the health club that she could walk to closed when she was 86. She was doing Nautilus at 86. And when she broke her upper arm by a fall when she was 87, she healed quickly and regained full mobility in it. And the doctor said, "You can't do that in your late 80s." And she said, "I'm sorry, I didn't know." He said, "You have too much osteoporosis to do that." And she said, "I guess my bones didn't know they have osteoporosis." Probably the exercise has helped. Probably being feisty has helped as much. She refuses to give in. Okay, I want to introduce a concept that I'm going to do a little bit different take on than the text. In the text, you will find a brief description of life reserve. And I'm going to call it life maintenance reserve to go along with the literature that I read. And this is an attempt. It's like the graphs that I showed of decline in the various organ systems. It's the same thing, except that instead of any particular organ system, what this graph is showing is the ability to fight off diseases. It's a combination of your immune system vigor and your ability to recover after some kind of stress. It's those two factors primarily. Resistance and ability to recover. Now what this shows, there are three lines here. And we'll start with the blue one. The blue one is the general decline that's going to happen if you are sort of okay and don't do too many bad things to yourself. You avoid the risks and the bad habits. The green line is the reserve left for somebody who has perhaps had more illnesses, perhaps had less adequate nutrition, perhaps has exercised less. And all of those, and stress, will affect how high your life maintenance reserve is. What happens when you stress your body in any particular way is that temporarily your immune system and your ability to recover suffer. The reason you feel like crud when you get the flu is because your body doesn't have much left, because it's fighting the flu. And the notion in life maintenance reserve is that while you're fighting one thing, if you get something else, it's going to go down even farther. And you're more likely to get something else if you're fighting something. So the problem with getting sick is that it lowers your life maintenance reserve and makes you more susceptible to anything else that's floating around. And if you keep getting things, you're going to bring your life maintenance reserve down to some theoretical level that is individual. We don't know where it is, but at some point you're going to drop below the floor. And the floor is the point where you cannot recover. Your body is going to have no reserve left. You cannot recover, and you're going to die. Now the problem, one of the problems with the way many of us live is that we, at any particular point, are reducing our life maintenance reserve deliberately. Alcohol, smoking, lack of exercise, poor diet, lots of stress, inability to manage our stress, all of those things bring it down. Chronic illnesses, genetic problems, all of those bring it down. And the more of those problems you have, the lower your life maintenance reserve and the earlier you will die. We die because we can't recover. The reason that we try to prevent second heart attacks, if you have a heart attack, you go to the emergency room, they are focused on keeping you from having the second one, because the second one is more likely to kill you than the first one, because the first one has reduced your reserve. The third one, the fourth one, will get you. That's what happened to my father. The first one didn't kill him. The second one didn't kill him. The third one got him. And he couldn't recover. Pacemaker didn't work. There wasn't enough left to work with. Ah, what's this? Ah, that's rehabilitation. Bring it. This is recovery, when you're starting to recover. As you start getting over the flu or whatever you've had, you're recovering. Recovery means your life maintenance reserve is increasing. If it keeps recovering, you're better off. But the problem that many of us have is that we don't rehabilitate fully. So you have the first one, you get almost back, not to where you were. See the difference in level. This person is recovering, but is not at the point he or she was at the time of the first insult. The goal, remember this, when you get sick, when you injure yourself, when you have the flu next month, now I won't start till November, when you have the flu, don't think that you are recovered just because you feel better. Actively rehabilitate yourself. Bring that line higher than it was when you got sick. increase the probability that you will avoid getting sick again. That's what rehabilitation is about, getting you to be stronger than you were before you got sick. My very favorite example of that is the cardiac rehab program, which I think no longer meets over at the gym. It used to. A number of years ago, the cardiologists here got really discouraged by that second and third heart attack fatality problem. They'd get them through the first one, send them home, tell them to take it easy. 6 months later, they'd die of a second heart attack. So they began to look at what happens after a heart attack. If you exercise and eat right and quit smoking and stop drinking and change the way you handle stress and all of those sorts of things, they created a program that got people on the treadmill, on the stationary bicycle, under supervision as soon as they could. And they worked to rehabilitate people, build their strength, build their cardiovascular capacity, get their cardiac output rate up, and discovered that it doesn't take much to get you to be in better shape than you were before your heart attack. And it used to be really fun to hang out at the gym and watch these old, everybody had white hair, you know, before I did. They all had white hair, and they would go over there, and then they would start running races. There was a guy in South Burlington who, after his triple bypass surgery, started running marathons. Not right away, but he ran marathons. He ran several of them in his 60s and 70s. That's possible, but it's only possible if you work at it. And what many of the men and women in that program said was that they wished that they had done the rehabilitation before they had a reason to rehabilitate. What is rehabilitation before you have a problem? It's called fitness training. It's called exercise. It's called smart eating. It's called quit smoking. You can bring that line up here. You can. I only have two lines on this one. There's no reason to stop. Neither of these lines is inevitable. The green is the person with chronic problems who's living a nasty lifestyle. The blue one is the average person. That's the one you want to be. That person will not get sick as often, will have a better quality of life, will, given a partner, maintain an active and satisfying sexual life, will maintain cognitive skills, we'll talk about that in the next unit, and will live to the maximum lifespan given for his or her genetic and health history. The goal would be to stay as fit as possible for as long as possible. The advantages of that, I've already mentioned that you live healthier and you're happier and you have a better sex life if that's important to you, and all those things. The other advantage is that the lower you are on that curve, the lower your curve is, the more you're spending on healthcare. The earlier you die, the more you spend on healthcare. The earlier you die, the more you spend on healthcare. We spend more on healthcare in the last 3 months of life, typically, than we spend in all of the preceding years. It is very expensive to die. And the younger you are when you die, if it's not by accident, the more it costs. one of my favorite physicians here, John Bland, who's retired now, cross-country skis, races, I think he's 89, anyway, he's cross-country skied all his life, and my kids used to ski with him, which was fun. John wrote a book about this phenomenon. It's called Live Long, Die Fast. Because the statistics are that the older you are when you die, the more likely you are to go the way we all would really like. How many of you want to spend your last 5 or 6 months in a nursing home? How many of you think it would be much better if you or your parents or your grandparents didn't wake up some morning? Just didn't wake up. How many of you think you would prefer just to be walking down the street and fall over? Dead. Would you rather go that way? At 95. Okay. That doesn't cost much. You know, if they try to resuscitate you, you might get a couple of days in the hospital, but you're not going to deplete your life savings on chronic care. You're not going to use a lot of Medicare for nursing home care. You won't put the nurses out of work. Don't worry about it. There'll still be plenty of work for you to do. But the longer you live, the more likely you are to die suddenly without losing the quality of life. One of my examples, I was in Austin, Texas several years ago visiting friends, and we'd been eating and drinking a lot, so we decided we'd go to their health club. And as I walked in, they had this display in the front lobby, and it had a picture of the member of the month. The member of the month, person they wanted to recognize, was 92 years old. The guy. So I thought, that's really cool. So I went in, I was doing the Nautilus circuit. He came in. And one of those things you wish you had on videotape. He came in, and he was wearing a cap. He was wearing leg warmers, the kind dancers wear, because as you get older, staying warm becomes a problem at times. And he sat down in the rowing machine, the Concept 2, and he started rowing. And I finished the Nautilus circuit, and I was curious. I watched him. 20 minutes, rowing vigorously. And at that point in my life, I was not rowing. I had tried it a little bit, and, you know, two minutes, maybe, tops, three, maybe, if I didn't row very hard. So he was rowing vigorously. He stopped after 20 minutes. I was taking a break, so I said, okay, I teach human development. Tell me about rowing. He was a retired pediatrician. He started rowing in high school on the water. He'd never stopped. He never stopped rowing. He rowed competitively until his children made him stop in his early 80s because they were afraid he was going to drown. But he had been rowing competitively since high school and had rowed into his 80s, and at that point got off the water. They made him give up. He said he gave his shell, his individual skull, one person, gave it to his granddaughter and came inside, and he was still rowing at 92. My guess is that he would now be 97, and he's probably still doing it. He was upright. His eyes were clear. Many of us, as we get older, get kind of a raspy, unsupported voice. He could have given this lecture without the microphone. He was in great shape, cardiovascular, lung capacity, all of those things. And I keep thinking, if he can do it, I didn't start then, but I can do it. Okay. So the way to live long is to live healthy, and that includes exercise. Rehabilitate when you get something wrong, which is why if you get the flu or anything else, Monday, you wake up really, really sick, do not come to take this exam. I do not want you in the room. When you are sick and don't feel like getting out of bed, your body is telling you to recover. If you get out here under stress, you will do two nasty things. One is you will give it to us. We don't want it. Do you? No. Julie doesn't want it. I don't want it. And you will get something else from somebody else who came sick, and you'll be laid out for 3 weeks. So recover, and then rehabilitate. The text gives you some variation of this. The list is short. And you can memorize it. Not just for the exam, but you can memorize it for your life. Huh. Interesting. Be sociable. Laugh a lot. Go to funny movies instead of the action movies. Alcohol is okay in great moderation. Some studies say one a day. And there's also something that you can't see there. If you want to live as long as possible, don't drink at all, but do it for religious reasons. That's a very interesting statistic. But people who don't drink at all, particularly if they do that for religious reasons, live longest of all. Now that may be because they're not drinking for religious reasons. That means they're Mormons, Muslims, any of the other, some Southern Baptists, Methodists, you know who you are. Because they are participating in a social group, usually a church, they are combining, along with not drinking, they're combining other things, and they typically don't smoke. And some of them don't drink coffee either. I don't believe that one, because we all tend to believe the statistics that we want. But if you do all of those, if you're 45 years old and you spend the rest of your life doing all of those, if you're a male in our society, you'll add 11 years to your lifespan. If you're female, it's not as effective, but you're going to live longer anyway. Compared to a person who doesn't do four or five of those. How long can we live? Let me talk about exercise just for another minute. Remember this guy? You remember Parks Bonifay. And at 15, he's not old enough yet for us to know what he's going to be like in his old age. But I do want you to see this guy. He's been in a number of ads. When that picture was taken several years ago, he was 74. A couple of things to note. He's not using his hands. He's using his own teeth. He has a mouthpiece. He's holding onto the rope with his teeth. There's another thing you can't see. He doesn't have any skis on. He's skiing barefoot. Which means they're going fast. If you've ever tried to do it, you have to go fast. It helps if you have wide feet. And he's the poster child for living an active life. I like the logo on his shorts, intensity. He probably lives life pretty intensely. How long can we live? Well, that is an interesting question. And if you don't do it now, but if you want to look at your text, on page 611 is where I am. What this chart shows is that way back in the Bronze Age in Greece, the average life expectancy was about 18 years. They didn't live very long. Rome, 22. Middle Ages in England, 33. We're getting healthier. Before 1789 in Massachusetts and New Hampshire, 35. England and Wales in the 1800s, 40. 1900 in the United States, the average person lived to be 49. By 1946, we were up to almost 67. 2000, preliminary data that it's now actually a couple of years above that. We're better than the rest of the world. We're not better than every country, but we're better than most of the rest of the world. If you convert that to a graph, here's a rough depiction. Okay. This is called a survival graph. What it does is take people born in a particular year, 100% of them. So at birth, they're 0 years old, and it keeps track of how many are still alive until the last person born in that group that year is dead. 50% is the average life expectancy. So that chart in the book shows 18, 22, which means people are dying off. Okay. And what's happened over the years, over the last two millennia, is that fewer people die in childhood, and now the average is 76. And what that means is that half of us live longer than that. And then what happens? People keep dying off. And the interesting thing about survival curves is that what happens is, even in Greece, even in Rome, when you got down to one person left, that person was likely to be over 90 years old. The maximum lifespan has not changed. And in the popular press, you'll read things about, can we live to be 200 years old? Probably not, unless we learn to slow down our cellular processes. But what we're doing as we move this survival curve out is having more of us live through childhood and adolescence and into adulthood. We're not changing the maximum lifespan. There's almost always somebody around who's 112, 115, 114. And that it's interesting who it is. A few years ago, the oldest person on earth, as documented by documentation of her birth, was a woman in France who died at 123. And I try to keep up with this, and it's interesting to do that because it keeps changing. But the last 3 years, since that woman died at 123, the last 3 years, the oldest person, and what you see is in the newspaper, somebody gets elevated to that position, and then shortly thereafter dies. It must be the excitement of being the oldest person. It may just be because they're really old when they get nominated or identified as the oldest person. But the last several have been 114 to 116. And currently, as of earlier this month, the oldest person documented is a woman who lives in Memphis, Elizabeth Bonson, or I've forgotten her last name, anyway. And she's 116. The oldest man in the world is a guy in Puerto Rico who is 114 or 113, almost 114. So those are the two oldest people, male and female. The oldest is almost always female, by a year or two. Not always, but almost always. What that means is that we have exemplars of people who live out the maximum lifespan. They're tough, they've got great genes, they avoid all the accidents, they manage to keep their life maintenance reserve up there, and we can aspire to that. One of the things that's fun about them is that they are often really wonderfully crusty people. To what do you attribute your old age? A small glass of brandy every day of my life, and in the case of the French woman, a cigarette once in a while. There's something about genetics. My first mother-in-law died a few years ago at 93, and she smoked from the time she was 15. She had absolutely no reserve capacity left when she died, and a heart attack killed her. Suddenly, boom, she lasted a couple of weeks, but it was one of those live long, die fast. The heart attack happened in her own living room, where she lived by herself in the house that she'd lived in for 60 years. But what she demonstrated by smoking for almost 80 years was that lung cancer is in part genetic. It will get your lung capacity, any kind of polluted air will, but lung cancer may not get you unless you have the genetic potential for it. At 94, had she lived a full life? No. Not in her family. Her mother died at 97. Her mother's twin sister died at 104. So we like to say that B had died young at 94, 93, 94, whichever she was. And she probably did take 5 or 6 years off her life. Okay, a few review comments as we finish up this particular unit. I'm not going to talk much about, in fact, I'm not going to talk at all about why we die. The text has some hypotheses about why we have a fixed lifespan, why we can't live to be 200. But essentially what happens for all of us is at some point the body experiences enough decline that it can't survive. One organ stops functioning adequately, at least one organ stops functioning adequately, and the rest follow. It may be very slow. It may take you 20 years to die. It may be one of those, an artery exploded in his brain, a cerebrovascular accident, and he was dead before he hit the floor with no possibility of any kind of recovery. But at some point, what happens is, biologically, the body stops being able to function. And all of us die because, for whatever reason, our bodies can't maintain the integrity necessary to live. So a process that started with conception, a cellular process, two cells, sperm and ovum, got together. That process continues until that gigantic collection of cells of all different kinds loses its integrity. And losing its integrity is, again, still a cellular process. Whether it's fast or slow, young or old, it's the biology that gets us. None of us die because we're not too bright. None of us die because we study too much and we learn too much. None of us die because our social relationships aren't good. We die because our bodies lose their integrity. Even if somebody shot us, we're still losing the integrity. Okay, where have we been? What would I hope that you would take away from this? The main points for the unit are on the web and in your syllabus. No, on the web. I'm sorry, not in your syllabus. But let me review a couple of what I hope are significant points. Each biological change that we go through requires some adaptation. I will put this on the web, by the way. And when you adapt, you have to somehow integrate the change that's taken place into your life, into the transactions that you have with the world. So whether it's being born, which requires adaptations, or having the brain changes of the 5 to 7 period, or lateralization of your brain, or puberty, or getting pregnant, or going through menopause, or having a broken leg, whatever the biological changes are, require us to adapt. We have to change the way we live to some degree, in some way. And a couple of examples. If you have the enriched experience in motor skills, if you start water skiing at 6 months, for example, it changes the way we deal with future transactions. If you go through puberty early, it changes the way you deal with adolescence. If you go through puberty late, you get more childhood. And you're older and hopefully more competent when you have to adapt to the pubertal changes. Having chronic diseases early changes the way you transact with the tasks and demands of adulthood. Okay, did we lose the genes along the way? No. Genes are still directing the physical processes in your body. But experience in the world is modifying gene expression. So you may have the gene for lung cancer, but if you never smoke, that gene may not get expressed. You may have genes that would create diabetes, but if you live well with a really healthy diet and adequate exercise, you may not develop diabetes. How well your biological development goes and how well your body serves you depends on what you do to it, what risks and opportunities you choose, and what happens to it in the environment, obviously. And at that point, we'll stop and take a 5-minute break and come back for review.
I just have one quick question. Like, how in depth do you need to know, like, what diseases kill what people at what? You know, like, all, you know how in the reading it's a lot of that.
Yeah. No, not really. Yeah. You should know generally something about socioeconomic status.
Okay.
Probably something about racial differences.
Okay, but not this disease kills these kind of people at these. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah. All right, thank you.
I don't know it, so you don't need to
okay,
either.
Okay, good. I was a little upset. I was sick on Monday, so I didn't ask for the weather. I'm better now, but a week.
Okay.
I hear there was a handout.
Right there.
And I actually have a question, too, mm-hmm. about the of essays that we're giving, are you expected to, like, analyze certain processes or something? Like, we have to describe, like, how the child develops the wounds or something like that?
Well,
so you can't give that either.
Yeah, it would be more specific than that.
Okay.
It might be something like the writing exercise we did. It might be something like what's the role of activity in physical development.
Okay.
Or
but it's not going to worry about, like, like hormones or like processes like that. I think
no, I tend not to ask the really detailed questions.
Okay, great, thank you.
Okay, I just had a question. The exam's Monday during the class period, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I'll be in here from the beginning of the alphabet. Do you think it'll go over because I have another exam?
Yeah,
five. I can try to change it to 5:45.
How do you normally do on exams? Do you normally,
how long
are you the last
are
person
the
in the room?
That's the question, because the multiple choice is pretty
good. They're about half a page. That's all the space we give you.
And you can't go over a single page. Okay. Then it should be fine. I can just switch to the other one if I have to. I just didn't know it was necessary.
Okay. One of the options, I'm not sure how we would do it, but it is possible that we could start you early if you don't have a class before.
I don't have anything before this.
Email me about that.
Okay.
And we could let you start. Typically, the average person finishes in about 45 minutes, 45 minutes to an hour. And then some people, because we don't have a time limit, we do have to leave this room about 5:30. But
yeah,
what we'll
the
do?
The other section of my class is coming in. 5:35.
They're the ones that are coming in. Okay. Nutrition, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. What we'll do is the people who are left here will walk over to Fleming and join the other group to finish up.
Okay.
But you, yeah. So email me about the possibility of starting
early.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Hi, she's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Wondering, I was wondering if you could record the review sessions, just because every review session you know, might be different and there might be people who can't make those times, so I didn't know if that was possible.
I haven't...
Okay.